We'll begin the question and answer session now, so if there are any questions, please raise your hand.
No questions. Amazing. That means I've been so good as a speaker. Just remember, I'm your guest, so don't ask me very tough questions. Mehmune, I'm still your guest.
Thank you, Brother Hamid. The question about you were discussing inheritance, and you touched a little bit on it, that these jurists are now discussing. This, as a general lookout, in the Quran we have various prescriptions of either punishments or something to do with inheritance. Are they as a guide, or are they to be carried out strictly? Hence, this discussion is going on in Iran now, or what is the take on that?
Thank you. A very, very interesting question, but a very volatile, volcanic question. You know, it's a volcano. It can erupt. There has been a lot of discussion about what parts of the Quran are unchanging and they are fixed. They are immutable and they are not subject to time or space. What verses can we say with a sense of certainty that these verses are not time-bound and they are not context-bound? They are supposed to be for eternity. They were not socio-historically formulated. And what verses we have a sense of variability? Mutaghayyir. Those that are context-bound, time-bound, socio-historically, politically bound, and therefore they allow us room for re-examination and re-evaluation based upon the new set of circumstances. Now, the difficulty is this, in terms of what I just said, الثابت والمتغير. It's very easy for me to say this on a theoretical, global level. The issue is that now when you have to come to nitty-gritty stuff, you know, at the grassroots level, like the very pointed question asked about law of inheritance, the Quran has given us the formula of distribution explicitly, right? That this is the share of distribution. Now, and the share is 2-to-1. The boy gets twice the share of the girl. Now, was this particular Quranic verse time-bound? Was it bound by the economic circumstances in that particular era when it's patriarchal culture? Men are the ones who are winning the bread of the house and women are supposed to be home. And even after the husband dies, they go in the care of the male members of the family. So they never had to support, so to speak. Does it then balance, the law of inheritance is supposed to balance that particular economic model of the 7th century, but now that we are living in a century where both are equal partners in terms of economy, then does it mean, would it be fair for you to live twice the amount from your inheritance, from your assets, for your son compared to your daughter, assuming they are both very good? It's not like one is a mischief maker and one is very good. Both are very good, you know, you love both of them equally. And both need money to go to school, both need money for establishing themselves. You know, this is the issue. Now, most people would have difficulty when there is an explicit verse, you see, that defines the law of distribution so explicitly, and it doesn't give us the illa, you see, what I was saying. I don't know the efficacious cause. God did not provide me the reason for that particular model of distribution. Now, it's a bit more difficult. When you don't know the efficacious cause, your reasoning does not have the right to engage in any kind of conjecture. You can't guess. God did not tell us. Unless you are certain by other ways of argumentation. In this case, I don't think we have discovered a way of coming out of it. Because we have the distribution formula, so we stay put. What we do, for example, the scholars will say, you have a right to distribute 1/3 of your estate the way you like. The 2/3 is distributed by the formula of this. So they would say one third, use it for balancing between your son and daughter. So use that one third towards giving more to your daughter, and that way you will balance the score. The question is this: if the system of distribution requires this particular act of interference, that means the initial act is not just. You see, we have to interfere now. But the God's law should be equitable. But I now have to play with divine law so that I can make things just. Now that's something to think about. But because, like I said, whenever you have an explicit verse so categorically clear and you don't know the cause, now you have to be very cautious, because then Quran can become a plaything. So you do caution. And I think it's the best approach is exercise caution, balance it, you know. But other issues that we have in the Quran, we know that they were time-bound, they're context-bound, and therefore we have every prerogative to re-evaluate them. For example, with the verse dealing with the witness testimony, it says 2-to-1. But we know why it's 2-to-1. The Quran tells us, it says, if one of them forgets or goes astray, the other one will remind her. So the issue is expertise. They were not exposed to issues, so now they need some kind of remind. It's not because they lack memory or they lack intelligence, or, you know, because they remember many other things. They remember the day you forgot their anniversary, for example, right? They have very brilliant memory. My wife can tell me exactly the issues and what street I was driving when she disagreed with me. She will say, remember on that street, you know, we were driving and I can't even remember. Okay? So it's not memory. It has to do with those issues with which you are in close contact, and therefore you can easily remember. So we know that this is based upon expertise and not intelligence, not gender. It's not gender specific. Rather, it's specific to one's expertise. Now, this is what I'm saying the new scholars are arguing. In Sunni school of law, they have argued that no, these are gender specific. It has nothing to do with... So one of the persons wrote, a mufti actually in Saudi Arabia, some of these Wahhabi, I think it was, I forget now who the scholar was, but one of the... And she asked the question, she said, listen, I am somebody who is highly educated. I went to Kuliyatul Sharia, Kuliyatul Fiqh. I went to seminaries, says the woman. And also I am well educated in other disciplines, whereas my son, he is almost illiterate. And the reason that you say normally you can't pray front and backward, they say, is because your mind will be drifted. This is not a proper way of posture. But, you know, we are husband and wife. So in that case, can I lead him in prayers? Because I know more than he does. If I make a mistake in prayers, I know what to do. This guy doesn't know. And the answer was, no, it is gender specific. He can be illiterate. Nothing to do with knowledge or understanding or iman. It has to do with God made you a man. Well, you should always lead. That's your prerogative. Somebody asked a question, you know, I mean, so this is, it shows a silliness as well, isn't it? But what I want to say is that, you know, although it seems silly, if you are a believer that everything in the Quran is static and is fixed, then it's very hard to bring about a just ethos. Okay? Issues dealing with penal provisions that you mentioned. Again, there are scholars who are reviewing it, that, you know, the idea of punishment is not a specific punishment. The idea is to bring about reform and to bring about sanction, to bring about punishment for non-compliance. That's the whole idea of punishment. When you drive your car too fast, there is a penalty. The penalty is for non-compliance. Now, whether they give you a ticket or they put you in jail, something. They argue that the penal provisions are there to reform an individual, to penalize him as a sanction, and therefore some would argue that capital punishment is no longer valid. You know, stoning a person is no longer valid, they would argue. And they would say further, given that we are living in an age where these kinds of things can be globally exposed, it can do enormous amount of damage to the prestige of Islam, especially September 11th. If you show these kinds of pictures, I have one, I can show you graphic that you will feel like throwing up in Somalia, where they are punishing a guy for adultery, stoning him. And everybody, there are spectators, in as if it's like auditorium, you have gone to watch. I mean, where is that humanity, that sense of softness of the heart? The Prophet is called Linta Lahum. God says about the Prophet, فَبِمَا رَحْمَةِ اللَّهِ We made you soft-hearted, Linta Lahum. It makes you harsh if you see these kinds of stuff. وَلَوْ كُنْتَ فَضًّا غَلِيظَ الْقَلْبِ. If your heart was hard-hearted, they would have left you. God wants us to be soft, compassionate, you know. And imagine you bring spectators and they're throwing big rocks at the poor guy. Imagine. He's dug in a hole and they're throwing. If you want, I can show you. You know. And then you will see what I mean. It's really so horrible. I can't imagine our God would ever allow us. You know. And this is why the punishment for adultery, the threshold is so high. You need 4 eyewitness accounts where there is no inconsistency, there is no disagreement even on the minute details. And all the 4 have to agree on the act of the intimacy. They have to agree. That means it's almost impossible. Somebody has to be really flagrantly violating public norms and social values to do something in public. And 4 people are just watching. And all 4 agree exactly the same. That means it is impossible. The Quran is telling us I'm not saying that it can never be done, but the Quran is saying the threshold is so high that almost you may never need to exercise. It means it's so horrible. The Quran says about ghibah. Why don't you talk about ghibah? He says backbiting is like eating lahma akhihi. It's like eating the dead corpse of your blood, of your brother. Now that is serious crime, don't you think? Moral crimes are also very serious in Islam. So, this is the answer that, you know, we have this issue still.
Then from your answer, it seems that certain part of inheritance
right.
are subject to discussion, certain are fixed.
That's right.
Like you gave the example that the non-movable articles.
Yes, yes.
Up till now, a wife is... wife doesn't inherit.
That's right. That's
but then
right.
Now it's under discussion.
It has been approved. It has also been approved.
That she can inherit.
Yes. Yes.
But as you said, now the Quran says that the discussion about 2-to-1, that cannot be changed.
That is difficult, I think, because the Quran is explicit. You know, like I'm saying, unless, you know, we need further development. But on the issue of women inheritance, it's only in Shi'i law that wife does not inherit from immovable properties, غير منقول. In Sunni law they can. But in Shi'i law, she could not. And they decided that it is unjust. Because the Quran does not say explicitly on this issue. That's why there is room to now navigate. But things that are very explicit, and you don't know the cause, that's the issue. You know, we don't know the cause. Why God said this particular way. If we can figure out the cause, of course, then we are perfectly fine to move on.
Any questions on the lady's side?
Yes, sister has a question, yeah.
As-salamu alaykum.
Alaykum as-salam.
I've got 2 questions.
Okay.
The first question refers to the... I wanted to look at things on a global perspective with regards to Shia and Sunni view about rule of law and ijtihad. And I wondered, what is your opinion about, I read somewhere about Imam Ali's sermon from Najal Balagha about the rule, the Malik al-Ashtar he had sent to Egypt,
right.
And how should be the rules of government for a Muslim land. And I want to know your views, especially as someone who's living in the States, as to how those enlightened views of Islam, which I believe are the true views, are the spirit of Islam, as portrayed by Imam Ali's writings, how really is big that impact? Because I read about it. It was presented at United Nations.
Right.
Some people quoted it. Then I didn't hear anything more about that. And it really bothers me that we have these enlightened discussions in small closed gatherings, whereas the main Islam portrayed to the world is that of the Wahhabis,
right.
That of this extreme ideology. And the world doesn't see the enlightened view of Islam as portrayed by the Ahlul Bayt. So I wondered if you could expand on anything you may know about what happened to that.
Right.
And a second question,
sure.
Will I ask that now?
Sure, sure.
Okay. This is about Azadari, and I did hear you mention about crying or not crying. That's kind of emotional thing. However, there is a lot of politics behind the display of emotion by Shia Islam and its impact on revolutionary actions. And I do believe that the institution of Azadari has played a very significant role in a lot of revolutions, not just the Islamic revolution in Iran, but the momentum that is obtained every Muharram by Shias to rise up against oppressors. So I just want you to please come back to that if you have time.
Sure.
To say that I don't think it should be minimized. However, sorry to go on, but the other thing that really bothers me now is there seem to be two schools of thought about Azadari. One promoting the self-harm aspect, which we know Imam Khomeini forbade, and that seems to have taken the monopoly of Azadari to themselves. Then there's the one that we, in this gathering, I suppose, would be supporting, which is not to go with that self-harm, but just to continue. And I just feel we don't want to go too much the other way either. So these, I'm sorry that my question is so long.
No, thank you. That's very good. That's very good. Thank you. The first question, you are right. Today, unfortunately, just because of the vast resources that the Wahhabis have, the petrodollars, the image that of Islam that is presented globally is one that is quite negative. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, resources, financial resources. But that's not the only solution. That's not the only reason, I believe. Within Shiism, we are very fragmented. We are very divided, you know, and we don't allow room for dialogue. You see, there has to be a safe space where we can discuss issues intellectually and without any fear of intimidation, any fear of, you know, being ostracized and so on. And I think once we loosen those things, we can do wonders. I think we have been blessed with an enormous amount of good resources. One of the documents that you mentioned is exactly this. If every person who is leading a state, or even let's say a Husseiniyah, if they read that document, it's just phenomenal. You know, written in 7th century by Imam Ali, giving directions, and you will see that the thing that permeates the entire episode is justice. He's talking about ethics everywhere. From point one, you will see, he emphasizes ethics all the way, through and through. You know, and that's why ethics and morality are really the pillar, you know, for us. And things that are just arbitrarily given to us that don't make sense. We have a principle in law that everything that makes sense by reason is also part of law. كُلُّمَا حَكَمَ بِهِ الْأَقْلِ حَكَمَ بِهِ الشَّرِ. Now, I don't mean to say that we just think something and it's out. But there can be an exercise of analysis that we can come to a conclusion. So I don't think it's just the issue of Wahhabi. I think we also can do a lot, you know, if we partner together and we do work in tandem. We can't even agree on trivial things like moon sighting, you know. And we disagree, we say each other's names, and it is so destructive, you know. I don't know why. It's not just us, by the way. Sunni communities have a similar issue. Jewish, you know, I have friends, they have the same issue in rabbis, in synagogues, in churches. So it's not just something peculiar to us. It is a universal thing that is going around, partly because it is not properly institutionalized. I don't know the reason. Partly this is the only place where we feel that we can start to dictate. I don't know what the reasons are, but there is a lack of that culture of disagreement. I think if we can just learn that, listen, we can disagree and still be respectful, that can take us a long way. That if I disagree with you, I don't just bar you, that now you are a bad person, you have less iman, and, you know, this kind of childish things. It creates bad blood. So what, we disagree? You know, that's perfectly fine. I think to have that culture is very necessary. How come in the academy, we disagree? And that's perfectly fine, you know, and sometimes we are harsh with each other at times, but that's perfectly fine. But just don't be rude. You don't need to be so impolite and, you know, discourteous, but proper adab, proper etiquette. We can disagree, and I think that's perfectly fine. So I think we are at fault as well. I don't think it's strictly the Wahhabi that we can blame them, although they are very powerful. You know, whenever I have a Wahhabi in class, it's going to be a very interesting class. Because his hand goes up very often. But this is not Islam. What do you mean this is not Islam? The way you understand is the only Islam. You know. So it's very interesting. But it's surprising. At the end of the class, we have this questionnaire because it's part of our 10-year dossier. They write very good comments. You know, they're very fair as well. That once you dialogue with them and something makes sense, they also accept. And they write good comments as well. And some problems too, but they also, wherever they feel it was good, they say so. You know, and that's the good thing as well about some of our students in the West is that even if you give them a bad grade, I've noticed some of the students, if they know that they are the cause of the bad grade, it's not that I was being a rude, you know, instructor, they still grade you well. I've noticed. They don't carry a grudge. That's very good because this is the only chance they have to get back at me. The only chance they have is to give me a very bad evaluation because it goes part of the dossier. But they don't. I've noticed consistently. You know? I don't know if people do the same. You know, I'm not sure.
The second part of the question.
The second part of the question, but yeah, azadari. Yes, I think azadari is something very fundamental for us, and you are right. You know, the issue is not whether we should give importance to azadari and remember this with sense of vehemence and this sense of devotion. That definitely all of us agree. You know, the issue is whether to make certain aspects of azadari integral part of Imam Hussein's mission. That's the issue. That is to say, that is it only in Urdu that we can recite a majlis and that makes azadari powerful and, you know, good, and if you recite in any other language, azadari has a lower category? Or, for example, is azadari very good if somebody is able to make the entire crowd cry with intensity, and then somebody who comes with a very good lecture, but he cannot make people cry because he doesn't like to create stuff, or he doesn't have the, you know, it's a training, by the way. Did you know? They are trained. Now, I didn't go through the training process, so I'm not good at that. I know my faults, you know. So you can't be good in everything. So I haven't gone for training. It's a training of oratory, of eloquence. It's a training, I mean, isn't it? You go for debating sessions. It's a training. Now, I didn't go for those sessions. So I don't know the art of, but I mean, if you are skilled, I've seen people who are skilled, especially in Arabic and Persian, they can really bring you down to tears. Ruzakhun. They're trained, very well trained. Okay, even if you desire not to cry, it's impossible to not to cry. So, this is the point. The azadari, the importance, the significance, all of us agree, is that it is central to our worldview, and that's why we commemorate every year with passion. That's not the issue for us. We should certainly use this as one of the biggest gifts given to us in Shiism, and it's very dear to us. I mean, it's dear to every Shia globally. It's amazing. Every Shia globally on this issue, we don't have a dispute. But as far as how to express that sorrow, how to express the grief and how to do matam and all this, you know, people do different things. Some people beat their heads in the Arab culture, some use hands this way, some do. The only thing is, don't do anything that harms the image of Islam. You got to be very careful. If you think that doing zanjir, you know, like I saw some people, they take off their shirt and now they want to go on the streets in the West, well, it may not be the best thing to do in this era. And then they see people beating their chest, let's say, or zanjir. Well, they love Imam Hussein, but I think it does damage as well, because they see us as barbarians, as savages. There they go again, those zealots, those fundamentalists, and they will do the same to us tomorrow. You know, so. This is the issue. This is the issue. I think we can do many things to promote Imam Hussein's cause in a very intelligent way.
Expand on the answer, if I may, just take 1 minute. I just want to clarify that this is another thing I read about the importance of the matam, and I, as you quite rightly say, there are different ways, but this is some practice that should not ever be stopped, the matam. However, what my worry is that there is the other, there's a group which is trying to push that to that limit of the self-harm. And I wondered if you had any advice about us as a community that doesn't believe in that aspect, how to stop that destructive approach, because really what it's doing is it's dividing the Shia community along a path of, well, these ones are more religious because they're doing that, but actually it's the opposite of that. I think it's destroying the image of the Shias in the West in particular.
Right.
And you said about dialogue. Well, even within the London communities, there are some mosques which are promoting that type of extreme azadari as the only way.
Right.
And how to dialogue with people like that without having a fight?
Yeah, I think that's the key. You know, this has been the entire lecture. We don't want to be on the extremities polarized. What the moderate position is something to negotiate, but we know the extremities. Somebody who says Matam is all hogwash, it's all history, forget about all this. That's one extreme. Somebody who says you need to do Saf Matam or Zanjir Matam, otherwise you don't love Imam Hussein and your entire Shiism is under question and screw. The extremities are there. We need to come to a point and negotiate the points. And we don't have, all of us have to agree on that point. But just there has to be enough tolerance and consensus. So, for example, we have here Urdu Marsiya, I heard, and English Marsiya. We should have, and it's perfectly fine. There is not this pressure that it has to be, everything must be in English, otherwise you're breaking a fundamental rule. That's another extreme. To say we can't accept anything but English. If there is a consensus, there are people who do prefer, let's say, some Urdu Marsiya, I don't know, things like this, and it's being done, it's perfectly fine. We should not take very categorical positions, depending upon how we can serve the community. But the matam itself, we don't want to give up. Matam means to show your grief and sorrow and sadness at the tragedy of Karbala. That's all it means. There are people who just stand still out of respect and reverence to Imam Hussein, and this is equally matam as somebody who is using a sword and hitting at his head. Matam is not contingent upon how much hard you hit yourself, you see. Matam has to do with something, like I said, it is very individualistic and you cannot make any judgment about the sincerity or the depth. It's not privy to you. So all of us can do matam, but in a sense of tolerance. The moment you say, if you don't do this matam of Zanjir, or you don't do Saf matam, and you are not a good... This is what I mean, childishness. This is, you have to come out of this. This is what I call a very, very low level of discourse. The problem is here, I must say. You know where the root of the problem is? There was a person who had a TV. It's just a joke. And whatever channel he flicked, he saw religious people, clerics. He said, give me a kerosene of gas and give me a torch to light it. I found the root of the problem as all these clerics. I just burned the TV and it's gone. Because all the channels are just clerics. Channel 2, cleric. Channel 3, cleric. Right. The root of the problem, in my view, just an opinion, it comes from the pulpit. Because we are the ones who are really transmitting information to you, and the people trust us. I mean, don't think people are critical like Mayfield. Generally, people trust us. It's actually a positive thing, I'm saying. Yeah. We get a free ride. We go there, we say, Salaam Alaikum, nice biryani, and we repeat stuff, we recycle stuff. Nice hadiyah and ma'a salama, and they are all happy. We said nothing to disturb anybody. The moment you start disturbing the status quo, this is where the problem starts, because now you feel agitated. People like to be in their own free environment and peaceful. The moment you start saying, we need some reform, islah, what Imam Hussein said, islah, then you are making the other person very uncomfortable, because this is not the way he did things before. Now you are questioning the veracity and the truthfulness of what he was doing before. But there is nothing wrong. You should not shake. Because our iman is not based upon doing zanjir matam. Our iman's basis is something very different. Zanjir is not the point of our axis that holds us together. It's not the qutb. You know, we have some other things that hold us together. Imam Hussein's worldview is a pivot for us. Quranic worldview, yes, it's an axis for us. But as far as Zanjir Matam and we disagree, or Saf Matam, it is not a primary issue. So it depends upon what kind of delivery I do. If I keep on emphasizing, and I can bring you tomorrow hadith upon hadith on extremism about these kinds of issues that in my view are, many of them are fabricated, you know, about baka, so about crying and making people cry and so and so. Now if I bring all those and I talk about this all the time, and we have, I brought with me in my suitcase, so if you want I can bring it for you, you know, and you will see. I also brought in my briefcase all the hadith about the virtues of Ziyarat al-Ashura. Now don't ask me, because I'm not going to bring that. I just read for myself, because I just recently bought the book. Okay? In any event, if I continuously do this, and you trust me, and of course you're not going to go and research about Islam, because you don't have time, you are professionals, you have other responsibilities, you're assuming that, you know, you trust me and I'm supposed to give you authentic knowledge. And if I continuously, you know, pound this in your mind from a young age, of course, I think, you know, you will come out like that. I think this is why it's so critical what Kumail said, you know, that we should start our education process of reform and islah from a young age. This is where we can formulate their mind and fashion them. And we have a hadith like this, that whatever you put in an early age is like inscribing and engraving on a stone. It stays, right? So I think we should start at an early age, and we should have a very good curriculum. You know, unfortunately, we don't have one. Very nice, forward-looking, progressive, high-tech curriculum. Rather than building all these fancy, you know, mosques, imagine if you invest real money. We don't have a curriculum, a syllabus. Can you imagine? I mean, it's very puzzling, you know, that after so many years living in the West, we don't have a curriculum that is in tune with Western issues. Look at some of the syllabi. It is so boring, really. I mean, I don't blame the kids for not coming and crying. You have to drag them, you know. If we had, like the Ismailis have done, look at their curriculum. I've seen the curriculum of the Ismailis they've published. My goodness, it is something to admire. Not everything you can agree with, but they have put some money. Aga Khan has invested multi-dollars to bring about very refined kind of curriculum for each level, for each grade, for subjects wise. No wonder it's so exciting. They use the nicest tools, the high-tech tools. So in the madrasa, it's like better than a school. But if they go to a very high-tech school and very good school, and then they come to our madrasas, really, it's a big gap. We are not living in Afghanistan anymore, you know. And I think that is also an issue, is that make it so appealing and make it so convincing and logical that as they grow, you know, they can look at. I don't want to give examples from others, but I mean, we should learn. The Jewish students are very strong. They have a very sound education system in the madrasa. The kids go to Israel. They go to what do you call kibbutz and whatnot. I mean, they go do service there. There's a sense of identity attachment. It's very interesting, you know. Even scholars who are Jews, they may not, you know, they have this sense of identity. Even if they're secular Jews, you know. So I think this is it. Well, how come the Ismailis feel pride? Have you seen? It's amazing. If they make you Kamadia, I don't know this, they're so proud, they tell everybody, and they say, my goodness, the Aga Khan has blessed me with this honor. And here if somebody becomes, they say, they force him, right? Who will be tortured this time? But they are giving money. You know, when they invited me for Miladun Nabi, the program at Rice University in Houston, Ohio, it was so well organized. You had delegates from different embassies, you had university professors, you had different dignitaries, you had a nice crowd of people, everything clockwork, they had nice play by the kids, so professionally done. Everything worked so well that you live with a good feeling, and all those who came, I'm sure, the dignitaries, how come Aga Khan can meet all these high top leaders? I mean, he's giving a very nice message. His community is giving a very nice message. Now, I'm comparing not to say we are not good. We do many, many, many good things as well. Okay? But in some areas like education, We are falling behind. Yes.
It was easy. It's easier for Ismailis to do it because they don't have restrictions like we have. They only have one leader, Aga Khan. We have so many marjas, you know, like as a group of this many people, like everybody has different marjas and they believe in different things. That's why it's so difficult for us to come up with proper syllabus and, you know, organize anything because everybody has different beliefs.
Yeah.
That's another problem.
That's a valid point.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's Khanum Kaniz. She is the wife of Dr. Hussein Kimji. So I brought some Canadians with me, you know, Torontonians.
Yeah.
Yes, that is a valid point, you know, but, you know, in terms of developing a syllabus, we can take enough leeway, you know, from the... Don't ask Maharaja, should I do this book on Islamic civilization? Just do it. You know, like the Quran says, don't ask too many questions. Of course you can do it. And, you know, he cannot even give an opinion probably. So what will happen is those who are around him will give opinions. Yes. Do good stuff. Do good stuff. Do proper, rigorous, you know, sound things with a sound intention. And you are good. As far as how to resolve this issue of diversity of opinions, you know, there was a proposal made by scholars like Shahid Ayatollah Baqir al-Sadr, Ayatollah Mutahhari, and even before them, that we should have a collegial body of scholars. Our time of 21st century is impossible for one person to be sitting in a corner and try to give legal rulings that impacts the whole world. Those days are over, don't you agree? It requires collective intelligence. I mean, can you imagine you work in a department in the university and you yourself are the only guy? It's not possible anymore. It's not feasible anymore. Rather, we have different specialties and subspecialties and sub-sub. It's that complex. And you expect one person to be able to define everything for us. So they were arguing, the scholars, that let's have a collegial body. This is very good. The reason being, it develops a sense of dialogue among scholars. Right now, the Maharaja, they don't communicate with each other, you know? There's no dialogue. Each one has their own particular foundation. Each one has their own particular group of entourage. They have their own Homs agents and everybody is separate. They have their own Muqallideen. There's no dialogue. So before even we can talk about the academicians getting together with the seminaries, those who are the clerics, the first step may be just the scholars themselves, the Maharaja and the high top scholars, they at least get together and start at least to dialogue and to give legal opinions after vetting it through different experts. Don't you think if there are 10 people surrounding the room, they can resolve the issue of moonsighting? I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure they can.
I mean, thank you very much. In fact, you probably have just touched the question that I was going to raise.
Sure.
And just like Muhammad Raza and the sister, I have two questions, but I'll say ask one now, and if Kumail allows me, I'll ask the second one later, relating to the same subject.
Sure.
The subject I want to pick up is Maharaja, Marjaiyat, and there's a great risk of me asking in this public forum, but I want to make it very clear that I respect our Maharaja, and I have great regard for all of them, and I've recently been fortunate enough to go and meet Ayatollah Sistani, and I got great feelings towards him as an individual. I just want to know, and I think, I really feel that this path, if you like, will probably at a stroke resolve the issue that the Shi'is face at the moment, including those three questions that you raised last night, that you heard last night as well.
Right.
I can go straight to the proposal, but if I may just give a little bit of preamble,
Please do.
In our own lives have specialists that we refer to in whatever field, and there are specialists in all fields. And of course, we must be ever thankful to our Maharaja who have taken this trouble and sacrificed their lives and decades spent in coming up with whatever rulings that they have, only for our benefit, for the benefit of people, us.
Sure.
So and it is great so that I don't have to do that work. I can continue my medicine, but I have reliant on this individual who has done the research. But my question is simply,
right?
And the path that I'm proposing is simply, for each problem that I might face, whereas in my medical field, where if I was a patient, I would go and seek advice from several specialists, depending upon the field, and then take the best. why do I have to go to one particular Maharaja? How did this become fossilized that once you have selected a Maharaja or Marja, you stick to that? Why can't I go to A for my first problem and go to B for my second problem? This issue of who is Alam doesn't come in then. I regard all of them as Alam.
Right.
But I want to just be selective in my process. And there's a second part of this question which shall come later. But do you want to comment on this?
Sure. I think that's a very intelligent proposal. And you won't believe some of the brightest minds agree with you, brightest scholars. Ijtihad in terms of juz'i, what you are saying, specialized kind of ijtihad, specialized kind of maraje, where they would become experts in their own particular field. Of course, they have to know the entire sciences, many, but they become highly specialized in their own field. This idea has been proposed. Unfortunately, it hasn't received much encouragement, you know. And perhaps it's just tradition, you know, when you have a particular tradition, it is very hard to change, you know. And it's very hard for us to make proposals to the Maharaja. You know, we respect them, like you said, very highly. So therefore, there's a sense of reluctance even to propose. That's why I'm saying that not people like me, but people like giants, like Ayatollah Baqir Asad, he's no small person. Ayatollah Sayyid Murtada Mutahhari is no small person, a great philosopher as well. Now, if these people cannot bring a dent in this individualism of the Maharaja, I don't think, you know, there has to be some other kind of mechanism that we can bring about this, at least a reflection about the issue, that maybe they can get together. And it can really bring about dynamism, because ijtihad is a very powerful tool. Normal argument they say is this, they say, well, you know, each jurist must do his own ijtihad independently. And he must come to his own derivation independent of anybody else. That's the meaning of ijtihad. A mujtahid cannot do taqlid of a mujtahid, of somebody else. So the argument is always put this way, is that because every marja should come to his own deductions, he cannot consult or he cannot talk with somebody else. This is normal, the normal argument they would say. But there's nothing in my estimation that prohibits, you know, any kind of getting together and discussing on a specialized level. I mean, imagine issues dealing with medical ethics. These are very specialized, you know, dealing with genes, genetic, these are very, very, very stem cell research, you know, brain death. And so I think the proposal, I think, is very good as far as chances for implementation, I think it's going to be a while.
Okay, second part, yeah. So I've turned it around, haven't I? You said earlier that to form this collegiate, Ayatollah Mutahhari tried, and it is probably something that we are not going to see because it's a top-down approach.
Right.
Here, this is a bottom-up approach. We don't have to ask their permission. I'm just saying that I, as individual, can't I refer to more than Maharaja to try and get whatever I think is best from A, B, C? So the reason I kept my second question in reserve was that I thought you would link it to also the fact that there is this institution of Homs that has developed. And if you look at it, it is rather unfair, isn't it? It's just like a professor of a university having to fund the university itself as well. And all the support all the students throughout his organizations or whatever. R&D is a very important, research and development is very important in any field, and so much so in Islam, and we should be supporting it. We as individual human beings should be supporting our institutions, but not necessarily through Qoms. I mean, if I go and get a specialist advice, I pay for it in the medical field. So on the same basis, if I want Islamic advice, I should have to pay for it if need be. What I'm saying that they...
I like that
yes?
point, by the way. Pay, I like that. Sorry. This was something I excited
but,
me.
My point was that we have probably the responsibility of the Marja having to run and finance and fund the institutions below them or around them is also unfair. for the system to have developed.
Okay.
Yes. So if you remove the funding of those institutions away from them and let those be funded by some other path, then there's no worry about Maharaja talking to each other, the professors talking to each other. It's not that the funding will be diverted here or there.
Okay. You got the question, right? You know, our objective, in my estimation, our ultimate goal, our fundamental goal should be to make sure that whatever proposal that we present brings about the maximum number of people with us. So we want to use a mechanism, a medium, an avenue that we propose is very, very effective in terms of its cogency, its convincing power, its validity, its usefulness. At the same time, we want to make sure that the prescription that we are providing is not such a high dose that we leave the rest of the community behind us. You know, the dosage should be in due proportion to the maturity, how, you know, we should progress. Now, present day situation, the majority of the Shia, of course, they do taqlid. Those who are, I think, it's a majority, right? Those who are at least coming to the mosques. I don't know majority, because I don't know about Qom, so I can't say. But I think many, many, many Shia would say that, well, the taqlid institution is somehow God-given and we cannot touch it. This is in their mindset. So if we were to propose, you know, even though the proposal is, let's say, very, very good, it should be something that we can bring with us, you know, the Maharaja on board and also the community on board. So it requires some kind of dialectics back and forth. So if our Maharaja open up, inshallah wa ta'ala, and if the Hashia, those who surround him, open up and there's this kind of dialogue, then perhaps we can get something through. But right now, if there's a fortress, there's a barrier, and we cannot reach the ears, then I think this will continue. But I don't think the solution is for us to take very radical avenues, because then it can also, you know, prevent our own growth. You know, we will then start, you know, disagreeing, a bit dissenting, and so on. So right now, it is not accepted what you said, that, you know, you do taqlid of different maraja. They will not accept this at all. You know, but I think it will have to go inevitably as the world becomes more and more complex and more global and high tech. There will be a need for scholars to work in consultation, you know. And one of the issues, perhaps, you know, that can facilitate this kind of collegiality is to remove money, like you said very correctly, money we should remove from any kind of a picture about scholarship. So if all the Maharaja agree that we have a Qoms that is centralized, all the money will be channeled to that particular foundation that is now run by the trustees of all the Maharaja who they have endorsed. So they have no say, they have no day-to-day operation control over it. But they give guidance, and then the Qoms money is being distributed to deserving people and also to the religious director who is the Imam here, of the Maulana here. So he doesn't need to be, you know, kind of submissive to you, because now he is independent, he is receiving the money from independent sources. Now, if that is taken out of this whole institution, at least it removes the issue of money. Now the Hawza should be run by this foundation, and it's a lot of money. It's multi-million dollar. The other benefit of this kind of centralization is, whenever one marja passes away, the money will still remain there. Nothing will happen to the money. There's a sense of preservation of the money of the last marja and continuity. So that's another good benefit that we have. And I think if that comes out of the picture, it makes life easier, I think. Then we can say, okay, we as scholars, let's get together and discuss. Money sometimes makes things very complicated. Your proposal, I find great merit, you know. But like I said, I think, I went to the question session yesterday, and I got a sense of reality, you know, a dose of reality, that the real world is not what we think here in Mayfil Ali. You know, we are a very small minority. You know, like I think Mushtaq Sahib said, we are living in the artificial world. You know, So I think keeping that in... Remember, the Prophet was also very progressive, slowly, step by step, piecemeal. Quran came in a course of 23 years. Imagine, 23 years with the Prophet. There's no namaz in Mecca for how many years? Almost 11, 12 years. In Medina, namaz even comes. So there is... We need to go, I think, at a pace that everybody can, inshallah, join us. So you are a bit ahead of the curve. Just wait for slow pokes like me. You know, we are going to join you.
Assalamualaikum.
Alaykum salam.
Sorry, I had a question about... you mentioned earlier about Ziyarat Ashura.
Yes.
And I know that there's a lot of controversy about that because some people say that...
Right.
You know, because Lana is in the Ziyarat, that it's not authentic. And there are other people that are very emotionally attached to the Ziyarat. So
right.
I was just wondering if you could shed some light about this.
Right, right. Thank you. Ziyarat Ashura, and the reason, the fact that it's coming again, the questions, it tells me that I have not provided a good answer. And I know that I'm not convinced myself. But that's okay. The best thing that we can say is this, you know, you can say, let's discuss this at an intellectual level about Ziyarat Ashura. Be very unemotional, be very distant and dispassionate, just we want to examine the validity of the chain of transmission of the Ziyarat Ashura, and we want to also examine the content and compare it with all the other sayings of the Imams and the Quran. We want to do two kinds of tests. Intellectually, nothing to do with my emotional attachment to Imam Hussein, another story, or my hate, let's say, of, you know, these so and so and so, the usurpers and the ghasib. So imagine that is at one level of discourse that we can do. But this perhaps is a level of discourse that is very difficult to do at a community level. Now, for example, Ayatullah Sayyid Fadlullah, may God always give him a long life, he's in Lebanon. He has done this research as a scholar, and certainly a scholar of high caliber. Don't doubt his scholarship. He is somebody very, very rigorous and very thorough in his research, and very aware of the modern exigencies and modern necessities of life. What is happening in the modern world, he knows. Okay? So a scholar who is of a broad mind, well aware of the context, and because that influences you. It influences your ruling. He did research and he came to a conclusion that the sanad is weak when it comes to the la'an. The chain of transmission is very weak as far as he's concerned, and he believes it is not part of the Ziyarat Ashura. But I'm saying this is at the level of intellectual exercise. You won't believe, scholars have written against him, and they've given rulings, fatwa against him, that this guy is mudil, this guy is led astray. He's a scholar even. He's a marja, he's a mujtahid. I mean, if you believe in ijtihad, why don't you give the right of ijtihad to all qualified mujtahids? You can't be selected. If you agree with me, you are ijtihad. I got no ijtihad. He has done his ijtihad. He came to a conclusion that says, all this aspect of la'an, they are not part of the Ziyarat Ashura, because it conflicts with the character of the Imam that we know from his other sources. It conflicts with the Quranic worldview. And therefore, not just the sanad is a problem, the chain, even the text has a problem, the mat. Now he as a scholar has every right as a mujtahid. But I'm saying even at that level, we don't have tolerance. And other mujtahids have, of course, criticized him severely. Severely. So, given that, I should not say anything from my side. I'm saying the Ayatollah Fadullah has said this. But I'm saying for us as a strategy, diplomatically, we know that cursing is not something that is fundamental in our religion. To remember Imam Hussein, you don't have to curse to make Imam Hussein's mission a success. It is not the core value of Karbala, right? We agree or not? Do you agree? If you don't curse, it doesn't mean you didn't do Azadari properly, you didn't Imam Hussein properly, right? It is not something integral. So what we can say is that even if you agree, even if you believe that it was part of the ziyarah, in the interest of public welfare, let's leave it aside. Given the post-9/11 context, and we have this intra-Muslim warfare, intra-Muslim sectarian violence, people are killing each other in the name of Islam, Shia and Sunnis. So we say, let's leave this aside for now, because it is part of maslaha. Maslaha is invoked as a legal instrument We invoke maslaha as a legal instrument when it's in the public welfare, both in Sunni law and Shi'i law. So now we can invoke maslaha and say, listen, let's keep this la'an on the side for a while. And in the meantime, we will read Ziyarat al-Ashura, but we won't mention the names. Isn't that a nice solution, a nice compromise? Right? Because if you argue that no, it must be there, you think there's just one ziyarah? There are many, many, many ziyarahs I can show you. How come you are just focused on this one? That only this one and this one you have to read. What about all the others? You think Mafatihul Jinan is the only book of ziyarah and dua that we have? We have many voluminous books on duas and ziyarat. Only the ones that we know is Mafatihul Jinan. Right? What about Sheikh Tusi's work?
I think that people are attached to the ziyarat because they find that after reading it for multiple days, they witness miracles, or there's some, I'm sure that in that book, Virtues of Ziyarat Ashura, it talks about that as well. How people come across miracles, or they see blood or something like that. Their life changes in some way, which is what makes them believe that the ziyarat is special.
Okay, that's fine. You see, but we didn't say the ziyarat Ashura has no validity. We just said the la'an, take out the la'an. Maybe the wishes will be fulfilled even better. Who knows? Just we remove the la'an, not the entirety of the ziyarat, and perhaps the imam will be even happier that we are doing something for the public interest, for the public welfare. It's something very virtuous. You know, so this is it. And there are many other ziyarat, by the way, that we can recite. But you know, all the ziyarats are good. Just this aspect is problematic, so we leave it aside. And inshallah wa ta'ala, all our hajat. We have, for example, you know, different du'as that if you recite 40 days, you can see the imam, for example. Things like this. Right? So let's do some other stuff and remove the la'an.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
I'm going back to a topic you talked about earlier. When you were talking about for example, you need to have a very high threshold for stoning. You need four people to witness the intimacy. But at the same time, it's a bit, we have to be a bit careful in the sense that if the person gets pregnant, then that's a sign directly. Or if they admit it, that also works. So the threshold is high, yeah, but at the same time, it can be reached. Right. Or on another side, if you think that the illah, the efficacious cause, is finding it nam that it actually happened, or yaqeen it happened, if you get DNA evidence, that's enough as well, right? So all of these things mean that, okay, at one level we can say, yeah, okay, it's a high level, but it still can be reached quite easily. And we have two problems. One that I see is, what does that mean in terms of, if that was allowed at that time, are we just pushing aside saying, oh, the context has changed? But even in that context, I can't see how can stoning ever be justified. Not just at that, you know, if we are saying that the context has changed, that is one argument, but then we have to justify its use at that time. So the morality seems to be, I mean, having stoning at that time for me seems very, very difficult to understand. Not just stoning, whether it's a concubinage or all these other the problems that we have. So that's one side of things. But then at the other side, this same issue, you have to have four witnesses. It can be used on the other side in terms of if a woman claims that she's been raped, she can't unless she has four witnesses to say that they've seen the act. I mean, some of these things are direct in the Quran, and they're very problematic because this is something which is muhkam in the sense that it's there, right? It's very difficult to go against. So how does that work in terms of rape as well?
Right. No, I think what you raise, certainly it brings in the complexity of the situation. You are right, to an extent. I agree with you. You see, on the issue of adultery, the level of proof should be so high. You know, for example, today if somebody is pregnant, is it not possible that it's through surrogacy? Some of the ulama are allowing surrogacy. So one can argue that she is a mother through surrogacy, and that's perfectly valid based upon the ruling of, you know, some maraja. So that's fine too. You know, the issue of rape, I mean, the issue of, you know, this kind of stoning, you know, we should ask the question, and the Quran talks about what it is. It is a sanction. If you agree that it's just a sanction to prevent any kind of repetition of this act, then one can talk about what other methods of sanctions would be, you know, as an impediment for people not to engage in this kind of immorality. Now, if that is the case, then other issues, other kinds of punishments can be applied. Secondly, we're living in the age of globalization. This is a very important tool that we can use. Is that given that we are living in this age when all these images can flash throughout the world, and this concept of preservation of the dignity and the prestige of Islam is something fundamental, right? So set aside the Quran for now, just on the principle of maslaha, that in the public, I should really show you the images from Somalia, and then you will see what I mean. If these kind of images, imagine, fly throughout the world in post-9/11, you know, era, it would just do enormous amount of damage. Yes. Yeah.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, Surah An-Nur, it says, "Well, yashhad ta'ifatu min al-mu'minin," or something like that. So let a group of the believers watch the act. I mean, that's clear as it gets, in the sense that it's saying that this acts as a deterrent. Like, people should see this thing, because it does so. So, I mean, us saying that it doesn't go well with us, it's difficult because it's directly against what it says there. And at that time, at least, that was what should happen. So,
right. But would you agree with me that the culture and the tribal values they had in the 7th century is drastically different from the kind of values that we hold on to? Tribal humanism and asabiyya are serious diseases, serious problems, and they regress. It is still the same asabiyya, by the way, the same kind of tribal humanism that led to the shedding of the blood of the grandson of the Prophet. Very different climate. I don't think that, I mean, I hope not. I mean, in 50 years, if the Prophet came now, if an imam was here, and then the tribal culture was very strange, you know, and not just in that particular area, by the way. In many other parts of the world, in the Mediterranean area, we had similar kind of issues. So it's not peculiar to the Arabs. But the law of vengeance was there, right? If you hit me, I have to make sure I get even with you at any cost. Even if I have to kill myself, I must kill you. And it has to go back and forth. Now, we don't have law of vengeance. In that kind of a culture, when you can bury your girls alive, infanticide, female infanticide, it's different, you know. So, but I think that even if you accept that, you know, if you say that now, even the values are very similar and the atmosphere, invoke the principle of maslaha. Right? You say it's not in public interest to show these kinds of images. Would you agree? It's very harmful.
Okay, so we're going to end at about 10:30, so I'll take another one or two questions. Any questions from the lady side?
Yeah, I have. I want to follow in the tradition of the two questions, if that's okay.
Because of the limited time, I'll take one question, and then we'll see if you have time at the end, we'll give you another question.
I'd like to ask both if we can get the answers in. I'm
only going to allow one, so choose one, please.
One was stored up from one of your lectures earlier in the week, and you were talking about how Quran and Hadith are the two fundamental pillars. And then you were also talking about how the body of law that's developed is almost like a tertiary contributor to any further development. But we also discussed this idea that those people who had developed the law were framed by their own worldview and their understanding of the culture they lived in. And on top of that, the law in a way has kind of circled back and influenced further development and further ideas. So what I wanted to really kind of hear from you is kind of what you thought the consequences of the following scenario would be. And I think it's starting to come into currency. So this is the idea that perhaps we need to go back to the very beginning and start to have new perspectives on that very early level of law. And I was hoping you were going to cover this today, specifically the area it's talked about a lot is in women's gender relations.
Right. Because, tomorrow, inshallah.
Yeah, the question, for example, always is, well, if you had female scholars at that time, would you have had a completely different kind of law developed? You know, if the worldview was not such that empires were defined also by their religion, would you have different kinds of laws around apostasy and interfaith and so on. So what are the consequences of going back right through the history of law and almost in a way beginning again? What are the kind of different outcomes that you see?
Right. Very nice question and very interesting question. Is that all of us are products of our environment, the place we grow up, the kind of training that we receive, the kind of books that we read. We are all nurtured by different things that the environment impacts us. We can't avoid that. Okay? So it would be really ludicrous to say, listen, I'm so immune from all these other influences and I remain completely insulated, protected from any kind of impact on my worldview, on the way I look at the world and how I define myself. It's just not feasible. Professor Edward Said's very good work, which brought this to the forefront in Western scholarship about Orientalism, that there is no such thing in the world as absolute objectivity. You can't say, no matter who you are, that I'm so objective. I am so distant from my scholarship, and you are a believer. That's even more problem, because if you're a believer, there is some attachment to the texts. But let us say, I am so objective, I'm so distant, none of this sociological influence ever impacted me, I'm just immune. And I haven't even traveled the whole world yet. But anyways, I'm just immune from all these influences. And then to say that this ruling can be generalized because I say so. You know, there has to be an element of what we call tentativeness. Whenever you say something as an opinion, as what we say, has to be tentative. You cannot generalize as the final decree. This is where the problem comes. We can say this is the best that I can give you now, but make it very clear that this is not the final point of destination. It is tentative. We have to have that sense of tentativeness. The moment you become qat'i, that this is absolutely it, and if you disagree, then you destroy, and you destroy the whole principle of Edward Said. What we can do, it is argued, is you can't remove the subjectivity in your worldview. What you can try to do is try to minimize it to the minimum that you can, but you can never remove it because your worldview is formed by different elements that you cannot control. I don't think I would be giving these kinds of lectures if I was only trained in the Hawza, right? I mean, it influences you, the kind of academic training that you receive, the kind of, you know, clerical training that you receive. It does influence you, you know, the kind of background that I had, you know. So I think you are right. The worldview is impacted, and I think we should acknowledge that. And then at the same time say, well, let me try and be as far as I can, even as a believer. We love the text. The Quran is certainly the miracle of God at the level of faith. But at the level of research, we try to be as far away as possible to try to see how we can define the rulings. That's the only way. But as far as removing all the elements of subjectivities, it is not possible. Okay, so we are all influenced. And therefore, we should not make grandiose generalizations. Always avoid this kind of, you know, umbrella kind of generalizations. Muslims are, Mayfila Ali is, I don't know, Stanmore is. These are called very problematic, grandiose, and overarching generalizations. A scholar who is refined, a scholar who is rigorous in his scholarship, never makes those kinds of generalizations because it shows his lack of scholarship. A person who is nuanced, he knows the complexities and he knows that he cannot make these kind of, you know, leaps. This shows the nuance. Okay, and I think that we need to do. One is don't make generalizations about each other. We can disagree. And a sense of that we are just dealing with probabilities. Nobody has yakin. We are all probable. And we try our best to correct each other. The problem comes when you say this is it. And my generalization is the only one. It can do a lot of damage. And we see it. We still have time, by the way.
I think we'll take one final question on the gents' side.
Ziyarat-e-Waris and Ziyarat-e-Ashura. Can you throw some lights on Ziyarat-e Warisa?
Yeah. Ziyarat-e Warisa is another ziyarat that we can read. Ziyarat-e Nahya, I don't know. We have so many ziyarat that we can read. And they are all very good. I mean, if you get a chance, and now that we have things in translation, if you can read Sahifa-e Sajjadiyya in translation, I mean, the way, if you know Arabic, Arabic, if you don't know Arabic, of course, English or any language, it's really a powerful spiritual document. So we have all this valuable reservoir of spiritual energy, but we have not yet tapped into it, unfortunately. Dua Kumail is also very powerful, you know, as you were mentioning, you know, somebody mentioned to me, exactly, you mentioned today, the Board of Trustee member, that when he read in English, he was so moved. But it wasn't so when he was just reading it in Arabic without understanding, you know. Arabic is good as well, do it that as well, but also try to understand, okay. So we have all this literature, and we have many, many, many ziyarah. I mean, this is the hang-up of our ziyarah, Ashura. You know, I find it very odd that how come they are so hung up on this particular issue when we have many, many, many other ziyarah. Did you know we have dua for every hour upon hour? On every day? We have dua for so many issues. So I think we should not become obsessed with this particular ziyarah. But this ziyarah has become the litmus test for being a Shia. That's the strange part. That you say, are you Shia? Are you Ziyarat Ashura? No? Okay, no Shia. Ziyarat Ashura believe? Shia. Why? Why? It is not the litmus test of our Islamicity. You know, if you're a swimming pool, you put that stuff and then you read. I mean, Ziyarat Ashura? No, let me read now. It's very wrong, very wrong. Ziyarat Warisa is a beautiful ziyarah that is recommended to recite on the day of Ashura as well. Sorry? Yes, but that's what I'm saying, is that those parts that have lan, you know, the scholars have, I mean, some have issues. And like I said, even if you believe it is true, in the interest of public amity and public decency, we can invoke the principle of maslaha. And it has been invoked several times in our history. Maslaha principle was invoked many times by Sunni scholars. We have also invoked maslaha, especially post-1979. So it can be applied in this case. I am not convinced of maslaha. Maslaha has an issue. Maslaha doesn't have a very rigorous methodology, you know, because maslaha can shift very quickly, public welfare, you know. So it doesn't have a very rigorous anchor, doesn't have a rigorous root. But still, I think we can apply it in this case for public interest. It's easily abused. No, nobody has read, I'm assuming.
Okay, I think...
It's like a decoration for us, decoration.
Okay, that's 10:30 pretty much on the dot, so I think we'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much. I'm sure Dr. Mavani will be around either tonight or tomorrow night for any more discussion if you'd like to have any. So.
Thank you for very good questions, appreciate it.
Salawat.